born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era. It's Resonance Rewind.
Captain's log, stardate 3715.3. Our investigation of Gamma Trianguli 6 has suddenly turned into a nightmare.
Captain.
The tricorder readings are totally inefficient.
Do you mind being careful where you throw your rocks, Mr. Spy?
It's over there, that way. I never saw anything like...
I am the eyes of all.
Well, The Apple, season 2 episode of Star Trek, directed by Joseph Pevney, written by Max Ehrlich. Max, who said it to do an awful lot of one and done shows. He wrote for The Untouchables. He wrote for The Wild Wild West. He did a lot of shows, but then that was basically it. He moved on. I suspect Gene Kuhn had a lot to put into this, as well as Gene Roddenberry as well. But let's find out from our Trek scholar extraordinaire what Larry Nemechek's made of this May the 4th, 1970 airing. Although I suspect it was aired earlier than that, actually, in terms of its original piece. So that's the second season. So we're talking probably 66, 67 here, Larry.
Right. If you want the air date, it was October 13th, 1967.
There you go. So, your thoughts on this particular episode before we find out what Jessica Burtis and Victoria Simmons make of the Apple?
Well, I actually watched this last night again for the first time in a long time, the whole thing. And, you know, to tell the truth, in the old days, the OG days, it was just there. It was, even back when I was a kid, you knew it was a little googie. With the wigs and the orange skin, and of course the Vol head and all that, I don't want to say token, but the token Spock McCoy banter back and forth about paradise, and you know, and the joke at the end, what I always call the Flintstones ending, where they all, you know, there's a joke at the end where they all make fun of Spock's pointed ears yet again, seems a little forced. But I will say that there's a lot of science flying back and forth, and Jimmy Doohan and Scotty is in really fine form here. You realize that most of his scenes, he's talking to the camera with extras standing around. So, you know, and there's no one else really on the bridge but him and some of the other extras, and he does a great job of it. And this is really kind of boosting Scotty. This is on the heels of Who Mourns for Adonais, or Adonis, or whatever you have, you pronounce it. And it is the show that really kickstarts the red shirt trope into being. I don't know that people woke up and suddenly said, whoa, they killed every single security guard off. But now looking, you know, it starts to add to that. But I will say that as much as there's a little bit of the cutesy 60s prudish American TV attitude about sex and just procreation and, you know, having babies, and they get a little almost like sitcom cutesy about it at times, and do the kind of looks and everything. And they've got Celeste Yarnell there as Yeoman Landon to do that. At the same time, I had forgotten when they get into the fight, Landon is right there with her, you know, with her martial arts, and she's knocking them over just like anything. So it almost like, okay, well, here's Star Trek in the 60s, maybe riding along a little bit where they have to be. But at the same time, she and the stunt actress that I caught the angle, they're right there in the middle of it too. So she was even though they do the Chekhov kind of creepy moments, but they're building his character to be creepy. Landon also got her moments there too. So as well as she's the one that leads she's the worrywart that's worrying about the ship, and Kirk is telling her to relax. So again, not a standout to me. It's yet another Kirk fighting a computer running a planet. But there were some cute moments. And the Apple has the only moment where we actually, it's on canon that the saucer and the warp, the secondary hull, the warps and cells, can separate. That's a line that he tells Scotty. And the cute thing about Scotty, you're fired. Okay, Scotty, you're at your job back. That's a cute moment too. So, you know, all in all, I guess we'll save the rating till the end, but
indeed,
not a huge show, but it has some standout moments.
Yeah.
It adds to a lot of our tropes, but it does that job. And I have to say, they shot the hell, who was it? Joe Pevney shot the hell out of what he had to work with.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly
trying to make long shots where none existed on a soundstage.
Yeah, if you'd had too much of a long shot or an establishment shot, you would have actually seen the backdrop, and all sorts of things would have been revealed. So they did cope well. And again, it's one of those things where I often feel that I do enjoy the 60s show when they actually went outside on location, even if it was a case of they went into the desert and various other aspects. I thought there were some nice areas within that. Having said that, I do use this episode, have used this episode, as an example of how you can actually envisage colonialism working or being manifested, mm-hmm. and the problems with colonialism. It's a classic way in which the Prime Directive is not just challenged, but is actively scrapped in terms of, obviously, well, the heck with the non-interference directive when we've got to save the ship, basically. So let's just ruin their whole lives and then basically say, this is how you're going to actually get together. Thank you very much. Still, at least it opened up an opportunity for David Sowell, of course, recently departed, right, to have his opening scenario in the whole system. Let's briefly turn to Jessica Burtis. Jessica, step by step, I think we're now almost at double figures for the number of Star Trek episodes that you've actually seen from the original series.
Ooh, yay.
So your thoughts on the Apple, please.
So I think that this reminded me a lot of The Time Machine, where this guy goes into a kind of ideal looking place, but there's actually something else going on under the surface, and you kind of have some wide-eyed people that live there. And the everyone being like white-haired blonde definitely reminded me of that creepy movie with the cuckoo kids,
so the midweek cuckoos crossed with George Powell's The Time Machine and the Eli. Certainly some of the antecedents for this one.
And then you throw in a computer there in there, so it kind of felt like a mishmash of multiple different things, but I kind of like plots where there is there's a whole planet that they go to and they're kind of having to deal with the wildlife. I love planets in sci-fi where there's dangerous plants and things like that. I do think that it got sorry
I said you had that yes
yes I love that kind of thing. Yes, even the rocks and lightning, like I love when the wildlife itself is a danger, not the people. But I think it definitely had interesting moral questions about computers and that are very relevant now with AI, and also then about how they kind of just decide, oh well, you can live a normal life now, and it's like, did they want this? That's definitely an interesting question. It kind of is like okay, Kirk. And Landon was great. I thought she was so cool. I really liked her character, and she was such a standout.
Yeah, certainly we have an interesting take in terms of the final sequence, in which I'm not sure whether the director, Joseph Pevney, had deliberately set up the Kirk in the superior role as the great white leader addressing the tribes people, etc. Very much echoing kind of images of James Cook, of course, when he also was portrayed in a similar role in Australia and Hawaii and other areas. So you have an interesting line there, and also the potential damage that was caused to the culture, which, as I mentioned, certainly The Rape of Shavi, which is a science fiction text by the African writer Bushra Amesheta, sadly again passed away, but she also kind of riffs on that side of things. Victoria, I know you're obviously slowly picking up aspects of this. You haven't seen the whole episode as such, but any thoughts on what you've heard so far?
4 minutes and 35 seconds.
Well, 4 minutes and 35 seconds is a significant sort of thing, and clearly in France we need to get more Trek to you. You know.
Well, I can go to the place I volunteer at and see if they've got any DVDs. So who's saying? I can go and try that. But I got to see I think it's one of the four final moments where they're blasting the, is it supposed to be a snake's head?
Yes,
and they're blasting
the serpent,
that. So they,
Val.
There we go. The papier-mâché serpent. That made me smile. But what I sort of took from that, and possibly quite a few of the Star Treks that I've seen, is that maybe it's because he's a captain, but he always seems to get his team into trouble. And it's a whole of the team that have to sort of put him back on track.
I mean, that's a fair point. Larry, is it a case of, because clearly James T. Kirk does undergo a number of crises of conscience in this particular episode, where he feels as though it is all his fault. He liked the smell of growing things. He wanted to walk in paradise. We know from, of course, The Naked Time that he was basically, you know, looking for no beach to walk on, or no braid on his shoulders, and so on. Is this also echoing perhaps the fallibility of James Kirk, that, you know, he thinks all's well, but suddenly we have a situation where, you know, as you say, thank the Lord, Spock wasn't wearing a red shirt, because basically he had poisonous thorns. He had a lightning strike. He obviously had to survive Dr. McCoy's cure to turn his stomach and so on. So, you know, he just managed to live Potions. Through it, really.
Well, that's another thing that struck me. He keeps mumbling or moaning about following orders, always have to follow orders. And it reminds me a little bit of Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, when Admiral Morrow, or three, I'm sorry, three, when Morrow was saying, you know, come on, Bill, your life has always stood for order and following orders. And at the time I saw three, I went, no, he's not. He's the firebrand. He's the guy that goes off to Vulcan instead of going, you know, for Spock. He's the guy that runs off and does it. He's the guy that retakes command of the ship in motion picture. And I thought, well, you know, is there an arc to Kirk here that doesn't get examined? He's talking about, I've got to follow orders here. I don't know, because what, his best friend isn't at stake, so he just goes. The bigger question, though, is, and you started to get into this about colonialism, the Prime Direct was about non-interference. So they were sent to assess the local natives. Okay. They didn't mean to get mixed up with them. Okay. That wouldn't be Prime Directive. But later on, we have everybody getting into, you know, they get into costume for Neural in Private Little War. Wait, no, they don't. They do later. But my point is, by Next Generation time, they're always getting into surgical alteration and costumes and all that. And I guess on Ecos, the Nazi planet, they put on Nazi uniforms. It's interesting that they don't do any of that here. And maybe that was just how quickly Star Trek was evolving. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, in Errand of Mercy, they're wearing Organian native garb. So why they don't have native garb here, I don't know. Maybe the yeoman
perhaps
didn't want to put
William
on the white
Shatner
eyeliner.
Was too much even for 60s television, basically. I mean, I know you like to rip his shirt, but, you know, maybe that would be a step too
I
far.
I guess so. But it struck me that at first it seemed like a Prime Directive, but if they were doing a cultural study survey, then why weren't they taking better precautions about being, you know, and it had been established. So anyway, that's, in hindsight, after you get over the papier-mâché Vol head, maybe that's something that comes to mind that we don't get answered.
Favorite moments from yourself, Larry? Any particular moments which we look through? Because clearly there's the tears of our initial leader from the native population, and of course that very clear observation from Spock that in answer to Dr. McCoy's concern that the natives were to achieve true humanity, etc., they took the first step. They learned to kill, of course.
Yeah, there were some pithy philosophical moments there. And there's, like I said, there was some good Spock-McCoy banter, although sometimes it's really on the nose, like insert Spock-McCoy banter scene here. But that was still ongoing. This is really early second season, and Gene Kuhn, I think, is making his rewrite impact.
And of course, let's not forget Walter Koenig as Chekhov, and the line, yes, which echoes very much his introduction in the Trouble with Tribbles, Jessica's perfect favorite episode, with Chekhov saying, it makes me homesick, just like Russia.
Yep.
More like the Garden of Eden, Ensign. Of course, Doctor, the Garden of Eden was just outside Moscow, a very nice place. Must have made Adam and Eve very sad to leave. So again, interesting that we're seeing more certainly than actually is given for other supporting members of the cast, apart from, as you mentioned, Larry, James Doohan and his role as Montgomery Scott. But yeah, your favorite moments? Was it Akuta saying love, strange words, children, love? What is love?
Brain and brain. What is brain? No, I don't know. Favorite moments. I think watching it last night, my favorite moment was the bit that I was cheering for Landon when she was in the fight. It was a little, there's so many things over the years. I kind of mentioned them in the highlights there, just little moments for Star Trek, apart from maybe some of the cringier, a couple of the cringy moments when they're being cutesy about sex and reproduction. But I was cheering for Scotty doing all he could. And, running the crew and all of them working together on the problem and, reasoning it out, being all the Martian with it, figuring out that if they could just, even if they can't break away, if they can just drain Vol's reserves, maybe they win in the end. And despite the depiction, realizing how ambitious, all of you thinking about where Doctor Who was in 1967 with their production value. And we're laughing about the styrofoam rocks and the papier-mâché vault head.
In comparison, actually, to Patrick Troughton's Doctor Who, much as we appreciate it, this was a bit like sort of comparing Dostoevsky and Brothers Karamazov, another William Shatner play that he actually was in, I think, back in the day, with effectively a kind of a genie. But Doctor Who was great. It went for ideas. It certainly, again, it wasn't a kind of, in the early days at least, a special effects spectacular. This was basic, but I think it still worked. It addressed that sort of scenario. Jessica, what about your favorite moments?
I think seeing Landon just kind of fight people off, that was really fun. It was very unexpected, so I thought that was a really cool scene. And also getting to see their when he's talking about how there's just no relationships in the island really that are romantic. It's so funny that the doctor? He's just like, oh, no romance? This isn't paradise. It's just so funny. And of course, like I said, I love seeing the dangerous ecosystem. I love that. I think whenever they go to a planet that looks very beautiful, but it's very dangerous, I think that's so fun. And it definitely suits the whole, Eden theme. And I like all of the themes around that with the apple and the snake and all of that. So I thought that they still had cool themes in this, even if I didn't like the plot so much.
Yeah, Gamma Trianguli 6, of course, being the planet in question from that perspective. Okay, let's talk favorite characters. Larry, in terms of the sequence we got there, we haven't really mentioned David Sola's Macora. Or indeed, we could also go down the line of those unfortunate security red shirts. John Winston, obviously, is still there. Lieutenant Kyle was around. Right. He was still on the Enterprise, thankfully. But we have Marple, we have Hendorf, we have Mallory. And, of course, we've got the regular cast, including, of course, Keith Andes as Akuta.
Yeah, Keith Andes that's a completely, it could be a completely forgettable. He does a lot with what he has to deal with. Well, you mentioned the tear scene. It's a lot.
You struck me.
You struck me, right? All right. We're going to take, this is their head, and this is what we do. Selling that is a naive, it's if you want to get into the science of the demographics and say, okay, well, they don't have kids. Vol only lets them reproduce when they need to repopulate. And there's barely 15 of them, the extras, and it's a tiny call. It's like, okay, well, talk about artificially maintained. Wow. Just the gene pool alone, but they don't age either. So they've got that Miri's planet thing going on in some way. But I've talked about them. I thought it's sad. You can tell that Celeste Yarn, this is so early in second season. This was probably a holdover script from first season, and they were still, in fact, I was just checking, they physically, Celeste Yarnell as Landon is wearing Grace Lee Whitney's old yeoman costume, and they've altered it, permanently altered it by then. But you can tell there were a lot of yeoman roles that were written thinking when the story first came in, thinking it would be Grace Lee Whitney as Rand. And by second half of the first season and on to the second, that had changed, and they were trying out different people to see about filling that role. And eventually they just gave up and didn't worry about that slot. But it's interesting to think if that had been Grace Lee playing Rand and doing all the high kicks and doing the combat, even if it was a stunt double, but just the character, what that would have been. Of course, here she's flirting with Chekhov, so that would have been different. So that, there's an evolution there, and they played with that, and they're trying to build. Oh, by the way, this is Chekhov's. This is Walter Koenig's first time without wearing the Beetle wig. His hair's got long enough to go natural. But I would say Landon, and again, I would just say I'd forgotten how much Scotty is carrying. You can say, well, it's happening. There's a B story happening, but he is the B story. He's running around and he's got a little support from Kyle, John Winston, but it's mainly Scotty pulling the drama aboard ship and, you know, looking at gauges and looking into view screens and things. So, you know, good for Jimmy to be able to shine that way.
We've looked, of course, at Celeste Yarnell over the last three shows in Resonance Rewind, for The Man from U.N.C.L.E., from Land of the Giants, where she was the golden girl in terms of that, or golden cage, I should say. Here, of course, we had Man from U.N.C.L.E. I think in every case, and I know when we spoke to Celeste, she also had the thought that there would have been the possibility, had either Land of the Giants or indeed Star Trek gone before the seasons, on returning to that character, bringing her characters back and seeing where she was going to be from that perspective. And it would be quite nice, you know, as Trek continues to expand and evolve, to maybe see, you know, certainly the character Martha Landon, seeing presumably she'd be an admiral by now, basically, at this particular stage. So maybe that's worth considering. Or maybe she decided to meet a nice Russian and settle down and basically raise children somewhere just outside Moscow. Who knows? You know, there's a different line as well. That
it's such a paradise.
Jessica, any honourable mentions or indeed favourite characters you'd like to put together before we start talking about scores?
I mean, I think Val, is that right? I can't remember how they pronounced it. Val, I think, you know, the computer deserves a mention for a character, because how did he even get there? Like, what drove this computer to just, like, get involved in this planet? Did we ever learn in the series?
And he's hungry. He's a hungry computer.
He's very hungry.
You need to feed him.
there's
a computer
so much
that lives on organic food. Now that's interesting.
I would love to know the whole backstory for Val, and just why he chose this planet and why he decided to make them immortal to serve him, why they needed to be immortal to serve him. I don't know. Val has questionable motives. I'm confused. But I think Landon was, of course, my favorite character. She was just awesome.
Not sure, Victoria, you would have a favorite character for the short piece you've seen, but does
no,
this...
No, I do, because luckily the bit I watched is actually quite a... from what everybody's saying, is literally the bit that I watched. But I have to go Scotty, because I actually got to see where he said, you're fired, and then you're rehired, because you could almost see his face sort of rolling his eyes and going, yeah, because where am I going to go? I'm still going to do my job. So I kind of like that. I obviously didn't see both sides of the story, but I liked that story.
We haven't spoken about the music, of course, which, as with all Treks, has its own particular take, and I think it works out. I don't think, Larry, there's been a soundtrack that's been released for this particular episode, but...
I was noticing that, but I think this is one of the episodes where they didn't write original music, but they tracked all kinds of themes, because you would hear lots of things, danger music and romance, and even some of the things from The Cage and some Vena themes. Yeah. So it's most like 3/4 of Star Trek's original series episodes were tracked. They would pay a composer to do a full score, like Doomsday Machine or This Side of Paradise. And then for most of the rest of the episodes, they would track the music cues in at the appropriate, you know, mood.
It's a classic case of upcycling, really, from that perspective. But nevertheless, it stays still fairly effective. Okay, Jessica.
Which helps us when we, of all the memes of the original series, the music is one of them. And so we think about the Amok Time fight theme, but there are other themes that are used from other shows that kind of just cement that. It's why the original series music is so much more memorable than any of the other series, because things would get reused.
Yeah.
themes would get you reused.
So, Jessica, you can hold until we're joined by Jared Palmer and possibly in Barnsley in the sort of second part of this segment, because we were blessed to actually have Larry for the first routine. Or do you wish to actually give a score at this particular moment for your thoughts on the season 2, episode 5 adventure, which of course precedes the Doomsday Machine, another favourite of mine, in which we see again Kirk in another problematic situation, but not of his own making, it has to be said. Jessica, any thoughts for yourself in terms of a score?
I think right now, maybe Jared will say something that will change my score, but I think for right now, on a scale of like 0 to trouble with the tribbles, I think it sits at like a 7, maybe a 6.5, somewhere in that range currently. Okay. Because I have liked other episodes more. I have liked other episodes a lot more, but I still thought this one was interesting. And like I said, I love Dangerous Planets. I thought that the Bittengard Cuckoo characters were interesting. And it left a lot of questions with Vol, but I think for me, it just left too many questions. And I want to know what's going on with this computer.
And Larry, what is your score as we begin what is basically going to be a William Shatner trilogy? Because next week we'll be looking at Cold Hands, Warm Heart. And then, of course, the pièce de résistance, as written by, of course, the late Arthur Weingarten, his adventures, T.J. Hooker, will be considered. It's what we saw celebrating the 93rd year of the great William Shatner.
Mm-hmm. I'm, you know, now thinking about everything, and I might often be accused of grade inflation, but I think on this one I'm going to hold firm and say I'm pretty much with Jessica. I'm going to say a 6. 6.5, maybe. Oh. I'm going to be firm on this one.
Yeah, just I mean, I can see that. I'm probably slightly higher. I'm going 7.5 to 8, purely and simply because I think the post-colonial themes and the resonance that it has for that in the 21st century carries an awful lot of weight, as well as obviously Arthur Landon and the lines from that. Larry, how can people actually follow your good self, of course, to find out more about Dr. Trek and, of course, the world of Trek and more?
Right. Well, our live shows and our podcast, Trek Files, and Trekland Trek's tours and Portal 47 backgrounding. LarryNemechek.com is the best central place. Larry Nemechek on Twitter, X, and YouTube channel is Larry's Trekland.
And hopefully
a lot of stuff goes up every week. Right. Last thing about this show, though, the thing that I always remember about it, aside from the red shirts dying, and if any part of your family ever knew Kirk ahead of time, do not go into security on his ship, because he had something to say about everybody that died. The other thing is, I remember hitting me, and he says, Formation L. Remember early on, they're on the planet? And I'm like, oh, I wonder what Formation L is. And I watch them, and they're just in a single file line.
So yeah, I thought it was obviously Formation L
is the fancy Starfleet word for single file, everybody.
Yeah. I was thinking it was L for left tube, obviously, but that's a whole line entirely. But still, maybe that was just the child in me at that moment that was already working that. But yes, thank you for reminding us of Formation L. Hopefully, Larry, you'll be back with us in not too many weeks, actually, when we'll be looking at Space Seed followed by The Wrath of Khan. Two separate, obviously, lines there, but well worth accessing. For the moment, Larry Nemechek, take care. Jessica, we'll see you in part 2. Likewise, Victoria. Now, time for some more music from The Apple. Well, we've heard from Jessica. We've heard from Larry Nemechek, of course, Dr. Trek himself. And generally, it seems to be fairly favorable. But you could also say that this was a variation on Return of the Archons, where the Enterprise is also being dragged down to a planet. Is it a violation of the Prime Directive? Is it a case of ultimately the Gamma Triangular 6 inhabitants, the Valians, shall we say, the children of Val, will be a lot happier for the whole system. Let's find out what Jared Palmer actually makes of this. I presume it's not the first time you've actually seen the Apple episode of Star Trek, Jared.
No, this is my second time I've seen this. So the first time I saw this is when me, my dad, and my brother, my older brother, watched this when we watched the complete original series. So this is my second time rewatching it. I think I did enjoy this episode, and especially see the influences it has on later episodes in terms of the season, but also in terms of later shows such as Next Gen, when they've gone on to the Prime Directive in some of their episodes. But for me, I think I did enjoy it. I do have to admit, I do think that Spock does need a break in this episode, and after the amount of attacks he withstands, from being shot at to being having to be like thrown away by a force field and then being struck by lightning, which, according to some IMDb trivia, that his shirt that he wore got sold off quite well during after filming. But I think for me, I fairly enjoyed this episode. I think it did sort of like play the dilemma between obeying the Prime Directive and having to go against it, because I do feel as if that although Kirk does try to reason with Val and say that we're not a threat, at the end of the day, Val was causing more destruction for the Enterprise. But ultimately, I thought it was a good dilemma for the episode, and I really did enjoy it.
Which is quite interesting. Of course, yes, we forgot that the three challenges that Spock was actually faced with included the force field one. We cover the lightning strike and, of course, being struck by the thorns, etc. Stepping into the way of the thorns, despite the amount of money that Starfleet had invested into him, which was clearly key to that whole strategy. Somebody who's obviously sort of headed into Gamma Triangular 6 because she's enjoying the sunshine over in North Carolina is Jessica Burtis. Jessica, you've had a few hours to cogitate on what Larry Nemechek said yesterday. Obviously, it's still part of the show for the Resonance Rewind listener, of course. This is part two. Anything else you'd like to add for your thoughts on this episode, The Apple?
I think, I think one thing that I hadn't mentioned, but we touched on a little bit, was the costumes with the eyeliner. I'm so curious about how they thought of having the costumes and why they're all very like white blonde and why they made that choice. But I thought that the makeup was very interesting. I just thought it seemed like something that you would see now in Dune or something like that. And I thought it was cool that it was in this show from earlier. So I just thought that the costuming and the outfits, they were definitely an interesting aspect of it and definitely made it feel a little uncanny and otherworldly and how uniform everyone was. I think it very much added to that kind of artificial aspect of this world.
Yeah, so Victoria, I'm not sure whether you've watched any more of this episode since the 4 minutes you'd managed to access via the web yesterday, or whether you've been moved to actually work through that. And we have to actually ask the question, do you use the same DVD facility in France that we use in Britain, or do you have a completely different area for that?
DVDs, no, I think it's the same DVD system.
Okay, this is fine. This is for useful knowledge. Right? Obviously, we need to get some DVDs to you whilst you still use that particular system. Were you tempted to seek out more from what we heard in part one of the program?
Photos. I've got the stills in front of me of I'm looking at actually the costumes and seeing exactly what Jessica's saying about the eyeliners and the details that they've got on the makeup is really interesting.
Again, Jared, we're moving, of course, to favorite moments. Jessica's already shared some of her favorite moments. She might have one or two more that she wants to add. But anything from yourself that you'd say, yes, that was a moment which I thoroughly appreciated?
I would say for this episode, I would say it's the bit where Kirk tries to talk to Val and try to reason with him. Because I think for me, that was sort of the Because I do see at the end of the thing where they kind of, where Spock comes on for the view of Tenneri Kirk being sort of like the Satan figure in this thing. But I don't think he is, because he does tend to try to find a reasonable solution. Like, he doesn't want to take away Val and like the dependency at first, because he thinks that it might cause the natives to digress. And the problem is that when he tries to reason with it, Val just isn't willing to listen. So at that end, like, he's done everything he can. So I think for me, it shows that even though Kirk is a little bit lenient when it comes, I wouldn't say too lenient, but he has a balance of, I will follow the rules, but if it compromises the mission and stuff like that, I will have to discard it. Sort of like similar with Matthew Gideon, like, he doesn't let, if diplomacy is getting in the way of the mission, he will like get rid of it and act on it. So I think that's sort of the moment that the reason why I like Kirk's character is that he just throws diplomacy out when it isn't working.
That's the classic cowboy diplomacy. And Matthew Gideon, of course, referring to the character as captain of the Excalibur in the Babylon 5 spin-off Crusade, which sadly did not last as long as Star Trek. But who knows what the future has in store from that point of view. Jessica, did you have any additional fun moments or moments to remember? I mean, we didn't really talk about Walter Koenig and Celeste Yarnell and their romance of Chekhov and Martha Landon, basically, in which I think Chekhov was highly attentive. And indeed, almost worryingly so in many instances.
You know, I think it's not really moments I'm fond of, per se. It's just the security team getting picked off has to be it, because they just really cannot catch a break. And I think that that's just, it's so morbidly funny that they brought a security team and they just like, they don't make it. I think most of the Star Trek episodes I've seen, that just hasn't really been, most of the people make it out of the episode. So that was an interesting change of pace.
Yeah, again, it's clearly the red. Well, actually, is it the red shirt then? Because clearly engineering wear red shirts as well. You know, Martha Landon was wearing a red tunic. So maybe it's just a case of red coupled with security is the big challenge. It's a little surprise they moved into a different zone for it from that point of view. Following on from that particular aspect, you're absolutely right, Jared. And it was the first time that Walter Koenig did not wear his Beetle wig, or indeed Davy Jones' wig, because apparently, according to Larry, his hair had actually grown out from this side of things. So again, an interesting take there in terms of the overall design and so on. Let's go to any other sort of comments you'd like to raise, Jared, before we invite you to actually share your score and see whether there's any contradiction, because you haven't actually heard what the rest of the team actually made of this in part one.
Well, I would say for one of my comments is that I did think at certain times that the episode with the Enterprise did feel a bit predictable, that the Enterprise was that threat again. But I think that's only because I've watched the other episodes of the series where they have Enterprise is either in jeopardy or something is pulling it in. So I think I did think that was a bit repetitive on my side, but that's because I'm used to watching episodes like that. And I would say ultimately, I think the location and the way they set the plants and stuff, I think it works very well for its time as well. And I think even to today, it still stands up.
And your favorite character? I don't think we actually asked you your favorite character, unless you're going to go for James T. Kirk again.
I would say it is Kirk, but I would also say it's Spock, especially the amount of like injuries he suffers in this episode, like from being shot at to being struck by a force field to being struck by lightning. I mean, the guy can't take a break at this episode, so.
Indeed. So, okay. David Soule, of course, as Macora, would go on to huge success as one half of Starsky and Hutch, the Ken Hutchinson half, of course, and Salem's Lot. Sadly, of course, passed away. And Louis Gossett Jr. also no longer with us, as indeed another Resonance Rewinder from times past, or at least present, from Planet of the Apes, the TV series, Ron Harper. So clearly we're all heading into all sorts of other challenges. What would be your score, Jared, for this particular season two episode of Star Trek, the original series?
I think for this one, I'd give it a 7. I enjoyed the episode. I enjoyed the themes of it. I think because I'm a little bit more used to some of the episodes with the similar themes that I just see it a little bit repetitive for in terms of the original series. And the one thing that I found like maybe the later on seasons tend to like sort of repeat the same lines of dialogue a bit. But I think ultimately I thought it was a solid episode. I thought it really presented the situation well. And I think ultimately it shows that humans, even though like we are at an age where we're pretty much enlightened, there's still room for improvement as well. And there's still questioning about whether moral ambiguity is right or not. So I think ultimately it served its purpose.
So keeping the solid seven thing going, of course, directed by Joseph Pevney, again, a fairly solid, robust director who passed away in the noughties, but again, known for a number of key TV series and so on. Well, it seems to have settled quite nicely on that side of things then with respect to the Children of Val. One thought I did actually have, which I think I'll share now, a concern about how can you actually power a computer by feeding solid organic food into it? My feeling on that and my possible sort of solution is that the food was actually burnt up and generated some form of energy or electricity, which then actually served as powering the machine, which is clearly why it needed to have some substance to effectively destroy and generate the energy from the food source, as opposed to just literally popping in a jam sandwich into your computer and hoping for the best. That would not work. And would be very crazy at the best of times, really, especially now. Okay, so I think we've settled that. Don't forget, next time on Residents Rewind, we stick with William Shatner, as we are for the next 2 weeks. And what's wrong with that, you might say, in the year of his 93rd time on the planet? Because we're going down to a show which was even earlier than Star Trek, The Outer Limits. Really not sure whether Victoria will be able to access that at all in France. Hopefully, Jessica will be happy to check out The Outer Limits. And just for yourself, Jessica, this is the original series, Outer Limits. Do not go to the 1980s or to any of the updated versions. Right. You're going the way back.
Yeah, I'll keep that in mind.
To the original 1960s, Outer Limits. It's a show which features William Shatner as an astronaut returning from Venus and returning perhaps not in his full magnificent self, because as we'll see as the episode develops, and we'll point this through, it's cold hands, warm heart. The early days of space exploration explored within the Outer Limits with, of course, William Shatner and a whole range of other fine folk. That's coming up on the next edition of Residents Rewind. Meanwhile, to Larry Namicek earlier, of course, to Victoria Simmons, as ever a delight. Even though she's still kind of using this as a guide to whether she should actually go and seek out these shows when she's back on this side of the ocean. Bless her heart, I don't think she even has Netflix in France. It's a terrible, terrible thing. But never mind. We'll cope, Victoria. We'll keep you there. So to Victoria Simmons and to Jessica Burtis, a huge thanks. And as ever, keep on resonating. The music that indicates the feeding of Vaal, or not as the case may be. But we have, as in the best episodes of the Star Trek original series, got a little coda, because we've heard the views of Larry Nemeczek, of course. We've heard the views of Jessica Burtis and Jared Palmer. What about Anna Koshkinow? Your experience of this particular episode in season two of the original series, The Apple?
To be honest, Alex, it wasn't one of my favorite episodes. I did watch quite a few Star Trek episodes. And this one, it was, I don't know if a bit confusing or a bit, I'd say, superficial, but I can't say it was one of my favorites. So, yeah.
Okay, that's perfectly fine from that point of view. Did you have any favorite moments, Anna, that you wanted to literally share with us?
Yes, I do. I would go with the death of the characters, some of them, because they were just so funny to me. It was how they were, the man that died because the flowers spit venom on him. It was just, it was there. It was out of nowhere. And it was, I don't know, I'd say, quite unexpected. And the most hilarious one, I'd say, it was when the other one got hit in the back with a stick and literally fell. He could have just, I don't know, I think it was a bit unexpected, because it's obvious that you cannot die from a hit like that, and it could have just as well been a hit in the head that would make more sense to die from rather than one in the back. And yeah, these are the ones for me, because they're hilarious and they do make more sense rather than they make more sense. They just, I don't know, there's something to talk about.
Okay, well, it's offsetting some of the more philosophical approaches we talked about earlier in the program in terms of colonialism and the aspects relating to that. As Larry said, probably not one of the most wondrous of episodes, but at the same time, still worth watching for a number of areas, including the way in which Montgomery Scott manages to be both fired and rehired at the same time in terms of saving the Enterprise. What about your favorite characters, Anna?
Probably I'd go for Kirk.
As opposed to Celeste Yarnell, who you followed through, the man from Uncle, through Land of the Giants. Did you not think that Yeoman Martha Landon merited this? Or are you still going to go for James T. Kirk as the overall a hero?
So I'm still going to go for him. I really liked her in this episode as well. But I do feel like overall, she's a great actress. Don't get me wrong. But I do feel like the overall episode did not help her show her qualities, let's say, or the act. I don't know, maybe it's just me that doesn't really fancy sci-fi movies or series, probably, and it's just probably that, I'd say. I don't know.
Or indeed the relationship she was having with Pavel Chekhov, or at least the relationship Pavel Chekhov was seeking to have with Martha Landon.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah,
what about your final score then, Anna, as we briskly go back to another excerpt from the soundtrack? What are you going to go for this one? So far, we've been averaging a good solid 7 as far as the whole thing. I suspect you might be one of the curmudgeonly ones this time.
Don't tell me the other scores, please, because now I feel bad. So I wanted to go for a 5, but probably I'm going to go for a 6.
Well, 5 or 6, somewhere between the two, that's fine for us. Next week, we still stay with William Shatner, of course. So interesting that he was your, for his character of James T. Kirk, was your lead, because next time we see William Shatner, as mentioned earlier, in another interesting role as an astronaut who travels to Venus and encounters an alien. Of course, it's the Outer Limits episode, Cold Hands, Warm Heart. Final reminder on that on this edition of Resonance Rewind.